What's up, everybody? You are listening to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV. It is brought to you by St. Vincent's Healthcare. I'm Tim Tompkins, and every single Saturday, you can get your health questions answered right here on WOKV. And this week, we are talking specifically about cancer, different types of cancer, too, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, and there's been a rash of what seems like celebrity deaths all in the news lately between David Bowie and Alan Rickman. And, you know, we're here to talk about it and preventative measures you can take. And I'm incredibly lucky this week to be joined by Dr. Hank Hill. He is a general surgeon and surgical oncologist at St. Vincent's. Dr. Hill, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Tim.
I'm so happy you're joining me in the studio. I mean, cancer is just, you know, it's one of those things where if it doesn't affect you, it affects a family member. And it seems like it's just something that everybody is somehow affected by.
Yes, it's very true. I think that one of the things we've noticed, you know, in the United States and even around the world, there is every corner of the world, someone is dealing with cancer. And a lot of it has to do not only with maybe just what we may be exposed to, but primarily a lot of environmental things that goes on, the way our food is consumed, basically our lifestyle, you know, things that we expose ourselves to. Sometimes there are things that we just can't control as it relates to just inheritable conditions that may be handed down from generation to generation. And that's what we call as familial cancers.
Okay. Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And, you know, you have that crisis in Michigan right now in Flint, and all the lead that people are drinking and all the things that could lead to. Those phone lines are open though. The number to call is 904-340-1045. Again, that's 904-340-1045. Let's talk about the importance of preventative screenings and what people can do to, you know, try and avoid or at least get really early detection so it doesn't become fatal.
Yeah, that's a great question and statement, Tim. I think one of the things that's so critical is about having radio programs like this that allows for the community to at least be educated. And I think learning early on as a child, even when high school level, college level, and when you're out there in the workforce, it's always important to understand what it is that cancer is about and signs and symptoms associated with cancer. I mean, everyone would appreciate the fact that getting a diagnosis of something early on allows for better control of their condition, whether it's cancer or something else. So in essence, if cancer can be identified at a very much smaller, earlier stage of disease, less tumor burden in the body, the greater likelihood of someone surviving from it. So that's the importance of what screening does.
Oh, absolutely. I've met somebody who is, he's right around my age. I'm in my early 30s. I believe he was too. If not, it was late 20s, a veteran actually. Matthew Hunter, and he's stage 4 terminal cancer, where he had to live his life 3 or 4 months at a time and couldn't plan anything beyond that because the cancer goes away, that goes into remission, it comes back, and they have to keep going through the chemo and the radiation. And so as far as the liver is concerned, what are some signs that something's not going right?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, people have to understand, you know, what their normal anatomy or their body is. And sometimes it's pretty humorous not to talk about that cancer as a joke, but, you know, sometimes people may not even know where their liver is located in their body, which is quite interesting.
But and it's big too.
Yes, it's an organ that's located in the right upper side of the abdomen. Usually if there's a significant tumor that's of a considerable size, then usually it's the right upper quadrant of the abdominal pain. Sometimes patients can present with jaundice. There could be a distended abdomen because of the bad functioning of the liver. There's a thing called ascites, which is where fluid builds up in the abdominal cavity because of some problems related to the liver function. Weight loss is another. And if liver function is bad because of the tumor, some people can have bruising.
I got you. And this show is all about taking your phone calls. The number to call is 904-340-1045. We already have a caller. We have Jenny over on the south side. Jenny, good day to you.
Hey, my name is Miss Jenny, and I am 5 years post-op liposarcoma of the left leg. The reason I'm calling you today is because most people have never heard of what I had, and I never heard of what I had. It went undiagnosed for 3 years. I was doing shows in southeast Missouri, and my ankle started hurting, and I already had a bump on my leg. So I went to 4 or 5 different doctors and even a surgeon, and nobody decided to biopsy it. till 2010. And what I was told is that this is a rare cancer of the connective tissue. I had a skin graft done on the lower leg. They were able to save my leg. He said I was very close to losing it. And I just kind of like for you to highlight what happens sometimes that people don't understand. Like this particular cancer, when it leaves your leg, if it ever comes back, it comes in the lungs. So when I tell people, you know, they'll hear me say, like the breast cancer people, well, I'm 5 years post-op cancer-free. But I started saying now that I'm 5 years post-op lung cancer-free. So, and this is another thing. A lot of people don't understand the sarcomas are not all the same when you hear that word. So there's just a lot of educating I think some of the doctors could do. But right now, I did fall Christmas Day, and I fell on that leg again, and I did call my oncologist, and what I'm doing now is just watching for knots, and I don't know if that's another thing. I don't know if I'm supposed to be watching for knots or the symptoms, because this is just something you can't see, and you don't even know it's there. So that's all I really wanted to say, and if you want to ask me a question, Dale, that's all I had to say.
Well, Jenny, I appreciate the call, and you certainly are very well educated regarding this liposarcoma condition. You are correct in the fact that it is not a very common tumor, and to that being said, a lot of physicians may not be very well educated about what and how a liposarcoma behaves. Yes, there is a swelling in your particular situation. You had a mass that was there, and not too many people may think about it. They may think, look at it and say, hey, you must have sprained something or tore a muscle or something like that.
I did run into a box.
I see. Yes, you know, and I find that it is an interesting scenario at times. It doesn't happen all the time, but I find it is interesting that someone says, well, I bumped into something or something fell on me and then this thing started swelling. That just happens to be coincidental, and it just happened to be bringing attention to a situation or condition that you had. So I guess whatever that you got, maybe you have to be thankful for that box. You know, for getting the earlier diagnosis. You had successful treatment. Obviously, surgery was a very important component for your therapy. You didn't describe about having chemotherapy, but...
Oh, no. Okay, let me clarify that, because a lot of people don't understand. This particular cancer does not respond to chemotherapy.
That is correct. That's very correct. You're very true about that.
I do have a master's in science, so I know a little bit about biology and anatomy and physiology. So,
yes.
And medicines and things, but that's what they told me. And let me think of another thing that was unusual is that the doctor told me if it ever comes back, you wouldn't know it.
Yes, very true, very true. I mean, it's
I get a lung scan once a year.
Yes, well, surveillance is very important as part of being a survivor from this condition. Local recurrence is usually the likelihood if once, you know, surgery may or may not be as adequate as it could be, but it looks like they did a good job, and I think that the surveillance for the rest of your life is going to be very important.
Well, so far, so good, and I appreciate you taking my call, but people think I've got skin cancer. When I the first thing they say when they see the scar is, did you have skin cancer? And you have to go into this, you know, I tell them, do you have a minute to talk? And I'll explain to you what I had. But
yes,
it's not the easiest thing. And I don't wear shorts much anymore, and I've tried to cover it up, but it just doesn't. I don't know, but at least I have my leg and I have my balance back. And
that's right, Jenny. I think that one of the things that, you know, even though you may like to cover up that leg, you know, you could be a spokeswoman for the cause of liposarcoma in education, and let it become a conversation piece for you. Be an advocate for cancer survivors.
Oh, I like to conversate.
All right. It sounds like that. Very good.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for that call, Jenny. We really appreciate you. And, you know, Jenny spoke to something, too, and that's the importance of talking publicly about cancer. And, you know, we've spent extensive time talking about breast cancer and how that impacts women. But I don't hear a lot of conversation about colon cancer and pancreatic cancer and liver cancer.
That's right. You know, Tim, that's statement is so correct. I think that one of the things that people don't really talk about it so much is because all of a sudden they may feel they blame themselves about something that they did years ago or over a lifetime, because there's a prejudice about the association between what you do to yourself to then leading to a particular cancer. And so people are very hesitant about it. But, you know, they got to realize that there are certain things that they may not be in control of, or if they've been living their life they thought was healthy, they just may not have been educated about it, you know, such as consuming extensive processed meats, foods in that
Absolutely.
Regard. Smoking cigarettes. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very fashionable in the 1950s and 60s to be smoking cigarettes. Now we know that there's an association between 50 known carcinogens in smoking as it relates to developing certain cancers. You know, interestingly, worldwide, you know, there's so much tobacco smoke being consumed, but not necessarily everyone who smokes cigarettes are actually resulting, you know, developing lung cancer, so to speak. There's a lot of nuances that result in it, that result in development of a cancer.
And if you have a question for Dr. Hill, the number to call is 904-340-1045, 904-340-1045. Again, you're listening to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV. Let's go ahead and go to William. William, you are on Ask the Doctor. How are you today, sir? No, William. So we had a doctor on a couple of weeks ago. And William, if you're listening, please call back. We're happy to take your phone call. And I was asking her about, it seems like there is so much more cancer out there right now. And it's just every day we're hearing about it. And one thing that she told me was that people are also living longer. And maybe that has to do with the influx of cancer. What's your take on it?
Well, it's a combination of things. One is about the awareness, and people are actually having a little bit more increased access to healthcare systems in which they're actually engaging in screening. So when they talk about there's more cancer diagnosis, these cancer diagnoses are coming out of various very early findings. So someone who may not have necessarily gotten their colonoscopy did get their colonoscopy finally. And they actually identified a cancer, but it was very early and didn't have to go through extensive therapy. And that's why the numbers are going up. Breast cancer is being identified in much smaller lesion where it is just microcalcification seen on the mammogram itself. And you're right. The advances in medical management of chronic conditions have allowed for people to live longer into their 80s and 90s. And you live long enough, you are going to end up with some kind of perhaps a greater chance of developing a malignancy.
So talk about colonoscopies. Mm-hmm. At what age should men start getting those? And what also is the difference in somebody? And maybe this is actually – no, just answer that question first. They're yeah. completely unrelated.
Yes. The average risk person should be at age 50. There are some subpopulations that because of the nature of their diet, the cultural beliefs and things like that, they maybe need to be at age 45.
Okay, and insurance covers most of that, I would assume, anyway.
Screening colonoscopies are definitely covered.
Okay, and what is the difference in somebody that catches it early on and somebody that catches it later on?
Well, the earliest situation would be that during the colonoscopy, there's a polyp that's removed and there actually has some cancer changes on it, but not invasive. In essence, their cancer has been cured just by that. However, it doesn't mean that you don't have another colonoscopy. So screening on a regular schedule is very important after that. The earlier the disease, such as no evidence of lymph node, no evidence of an invasive component that goes beyond the confines of the mucosa, you have to have some surgery. So surgery then plays a role in staging as well as cure. So if there are no lymph nodes involved when the tumor has been removed, then you actually don't have to worry about chemotherapy. With that even being said, what's beautiful about research and the advancement in technology is the study of the molecular behavior and the genetic profile of some of these tumors today. Not only with just colorectal cancer, but even breast cancer and a variety of head and neck cancers. With that being said, we can actually identify if a patient does not even have lymph node involvement, their molecular profile for their tumor may put them in a category of being high risk for developing metastatic disease in the future. They would be advised on getting chemotherapy.
So is there some sort of How can you really assess your risk and whether or not your risk is average?
It really based upon family history. Mm-hmm. So if you understand and you have a family discussion about, well, you know, can you tell me about Auntie? No one really told me about her many years ago about why she died because no one really wanted to talk about cancer. Someone in that family does know what has happened to that Auntie. So eventually, you know, it's good to be able to have an investigation of your family history. Know what your grandparents had, your own parents, aunts and uncles, even cousins. And that's the kind of conversation I have with a lot of my cancer patients. And they're really surprised that, you know, someone like myself would take the time to do that kind of thing. It creates a pedigree of understanding where their family history risks are. They then, if there's a tremendous amount of cancer in the family, they are definitely high risk. In essence, they may actually be identifying a familial inheritable risk syndrome.
Okay, you are listening to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV. So lucky today, I am joined by Dr. Hill here in the studio with me, and we have plenty of time to answer any questions you might have about really a lot of things involving cancer. And so please do call in. Those phone lines are open, 904-340-1045. A lot of time coming up. Stay with us. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV, which is very much brought to you by St. Vincent's Healthcare. Very fortunate today, I have Dr. Hank Hill in the studio with us. He is a general surgeon from St. Vincent's Healthcare, as well as a surgical oncologist. And given everything that's been the news between David Bowie and Alan Rickman, and it just seems like cancer's everywhere, and you know it affects men as well as women. And so it seems like pancreatic cancer, something you don't hear a lot about. What is it?
Well, pancreatic cancer, you know, the first thing is understanding the organ itself. You know, the pancreas is an organ that is very important for digestive metabolism of the food that we eat, as well as production of insulin. It's located somewhere right between the duodenum, behind the stomach. And very critical for how we live and process our nutrition. The most common cancer of the pancreas is the pancreatic ductal carcinoma or adenocarcinoma. There are other cells that are in the pancreas called islet cells, and islet cell tumors or neuroendocrine tumors are an alternative. However, the pancreas adenocarcinoma is the one that has the quickest growth, and it usually will result in significant weight loss because what happens? When the cancer of the pancreas develops, it affects the way we are able to metabolize our food properly and get nutrition. So a lot of patients will experience weight loss. The worst scenario, develop jaundice because of the obstruction of the bile duct that's very intimately associated with the pancreas.
And that's a symptom of liver cancer as well?
Yes. Then that gets to show you the relationship between the two. They're very closely related to one another.
So there's liver cancer, and I was reading about liver cancer, and we aren't going to jump from pancreatic cancer already, but it seems like there, if you get a cancer in a certain part of your stomach, that can spread to the liver as well.
That's very true. One of the things is that the liver, we understand, you know, receives a lot of blood flow from the GI tract in general. And, you know, it's a filter for the body, so to speak. It detoxifies a lot of things that goes on. So when tumor cells have an opportunity to metastasize due to its ability to want to survive, it will spread through the bloodstream that's feeding off from the intestines that go and filter right through the liver. And then can it establish a new home in the liver.
Yeah. You're listening to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV. If you have a question for Dr. Hill, the number is 904-340-1045. Again, that's 904-340-1045. Going back to pancreatic cancer, and how can people check to see if they have it?
It's one of the toughest things to do screening for.
Oh, good.
It's very difficult. So it's one of those stealthy types of tumors. Understanding some of the basic things, it's very common among men that will be over 50 years of age, particularly being a tobacco smoker, have some significant history of alcohol consumption. One of the things that I always find as very critical is all of a sudden a person like that developing diabetes for some reason and some weight loss. That right there is a very key sign and symptom, and therefore should be evaluated for pancreas malignancy.
So you're looking at sudden weight loss and developing diabetes right away, and you said men over the age of 50?
That's right, especially when there's no significant family history of diabetes. Why all of a sudden you're a diabetic?
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. And I see those phone lines lighting up. I can't wait to come back and take your guys' call. Again, that's 904-340-1045. You're listening to Ask the Doctor. It's brought to you by St. Vincent's. I have Dr. Hill here in the studio with us, and we have news, weather, and traffic coming up right now.
Style.
What's up, everybody? You are listening to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV. And thank you so very much for joining us. It is cold outside today. When is the last time you have felt this kind of cold, Dr. Hill?
Oh, that was up in New York.
Okay, so recently?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I don't know about you, but it is too much for me. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you're listening to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV. Dr. Hank Hill is in the studio with us, and given everything that's been going on in the news between David Bowie and Alan Rickman, and just seems to be like there is, we need to talk about cancer because it seems like it is everywhere. And so, like I said, I have Dr. Hank Hill in the studio with us. He is a general surgeon and surgical oncologist at St. Vincent's, and the show's all about you. The phone lines are open and we encourage you to call in if you have a question. That number is 904-340-1045. Again, that's 340-1045. Being as this show is all about the callers, let's go ahead and go straight to the phone lines. Shirley over on the north side. Shirley, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I have a question. I tuned in a little late in the show, but I'm interested in the subject today. As a person who has pancreatitis and has been diagnosed, like 15 years ago, I know you're talking about pancreatic cancer, but is that something that I should be aware of more than the average person to look out for? And if so, what measures do I take to prevent that from happening?
Well, Shirley, great question. One of the things that researchers have been identified with regard to the development of cancer is a chronic inflammatory condition that exists within the body and or organ overall. Now, pancreatitis can eventually lead to a pancreas cancer. However, once the offending source of the inflammation has been under control and you don't have any bouts of recurrent pancreatitis, you can essentially, reduce the risk of developing it. There are other really, fine details with regards to what goes on at the cellular level and genetic level of the cells that really dictate, what's going to happen eventually to the outcome of that and the development of a tumor.
Can you
tell me what was the source of your pancreatitis? What happened? What was the cause of it?
I had a stone and it wasn't removed in time, and so my liver blackened and led to the pancreatitis.
Yes, that gallstone goes down that bile duct and actually blocks the pancreatic duct also because it goes out one valve there.
It sounds like that must have been really painful, Shirley. I hope you didn't have to sit with that for too long, did you?
No, I didn't, but thank you guys, and you do a wonderful job on the show. Thank you for all the information.
Thanks for your question,
Shirley.
Thank
you so much, Shirley. We appreciate you. She brings up a really good point. Pancreatitis, I've known many people myself who have had pancreatitis, and it sounds like as long as the pancreatitis is under control, they don't have such an increased risk of pancreatic cancer?
Yes, that's very true. One of the things that's so remarkable about the pancreas, it's not very – it doesn't be able to behave well to injury. And it's one of those organs that we have to really seriously respect. Alcoholism really does cause a bad problem with pancreas, as does with the liver.
So we're talking about liver cancer as well. There's two different types of liver cancer. There's the type that is, I guess it starts and it's right there in the liver. And the other one is if it starts somewhere else in your stomach and then it passes on to the liver. Can you tell me a little bit about those two? Are the symptoms the same? How do people know? Are they equally as dangerous?
Well, the primary liver cancer obviously comes from the actual liver cell itself. And there are some conditions, usually the one that's called hepatocellular carcinoma is the most common. And there is a variety of treatments associated with it. The importance is about the size of the tumor. What are the other issues that are associated with it? One of the things that's critical is understanding that the hepatitis infection is a risk for developing malignancy of the liver. Cirrhosis of the liver also is a risk factor as well. And like I said before, the liver functions to detoxify the body. So whatever we are consuming or being exposed to, that liver is under the responsibility of being exposed to all those kinds of things. And over time, things can happen to that liver.
So if you had to advise somebody on maybe ways to reduce the risk of getting
you know, liver or any other kind of cancers? Is there dietary changes? Is there exercise? Is there anything people can do?
Well, we've already recognized that, you know, prevention is just as much as, if not better than having to deal with having to cure it. If we understand that there are better foods to consume versus some of the fast foods, you know, the fast food industry is robust. It has, you know, satisfied the taste buds, but they may not necessarily satisfy the body buds, so to speak. And I think that when people are more educated about the choices of how their food is prepared, they're going to do a better job in keep maintaining their health. We've actually already understand the association between excessive weight gain and or what's called obesity is associated with greater risk of developing a malignancy. And the obesity issue is all related to chronic inflammation process that's going throughout the body. You know, it's one thing to look at someone's physical features, but what's going on inside their organ as well. The fat actually builds up inside the liver as well and in the pancreas.
The liver is a remarkably powerful part of your body too, where it can you can go in there, and I guess it's called a liver resection, where you go in, you remove the tumor, and you can the liver grows back. I guess you can remove almost 75% of the tumor, and it grows back.
Well, I think one of the things is about size. The smaller the tumor is, someone can go right to surgery. The larger it is, you know, a multidisciplinary team that would include the surgeon, the medical oncologist, and the radiation oncologist, and even an interventional radiologist. That's someone who actually is able to insert special catheters into the arteries that actually feed the blood to the liver tumors. One of the things that's helpful is that the use of technology have allowed us to actually reduce the size of these tumors by injecting certain kinds of things such as chemotherapy or special type of spheres that actually deliver radiation right to the tumor. And the medical oncologist would work with that interventional radiologist, who would then also maybe give chemotherapy through their IV system to allow these tumors to get smaller. That's where the surgeon comes in and is able to then do a resection. The other option is using what's called portal vein embolization. You basically block the venous flow to that area of the liver, allowing that tumor and that portion of the liver to basically die, and then allow for the more healthy portion of the liver to actually grow and get larger so that it can prepare that person for definitive surgery.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about your practice at St. Vincent's?
Well, I have a variety of malignancies I do take care of, everything from skin cancers, breast cancer, esophageal, gastric, the liver, pancreas, small intestine, colorectal. It's a broad range.
Okay. And the number, if anyone is too shy to call up the show, and I understand, but the number, if you want to reach Dr. Hill at his office, that is 904-450-6305. Again, that's 904-450-6305. The number to call into the show, though, is 340-1045. And so, you know, we're sitting here, we're talking about cancer, and walk me through the process. Somebody finds out that they do have some sort of liver cancer. What happens next?
Yes, usually when they are presenting with some symptoms and signs that are associated with it, most often they go to see a gastroenterologist initially. Mm-hmm. And the gastroenterologist will be able to do some studies such as a CT scan or ultrasound of the abdomen, and then they actually will show that there is a liver tumor that's present. Subsequently, the important thing is, you know, before you can do anything, you got to know what you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. So is it a primary tumor of the liver, or is it something that's metastatic? That spread from somewhere else.
Is that what that means, metastatic?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Right. Because it's as you mentioned previously, colorectal tumors can actually spread to the liver. Also with breast. Breast can actually circulate through the bloodstream and then actually get into the liver as well. So understanding someone's previous history is also important. Were they also already a cancer survivor from something else? And that's where you then may have to clue in that there may be a metastatic tumor. Well, what we'd like to do is do a biopsy, and we can do a CT-guided biopsy or ultrasound-guided biopsy that gets tissue out from that tumor, and the pathologist evaluates it and then makes the confirms the diagnosis.
Okay. Is there a certain time when people should go in and get checked out, get screened for this, or should they wait until they have symptoms? You mentioned with a colonoscopy that's right around the age of 50, men should start getting checked. What about with the liver?
Well, what's helpful is that you know, everyone should be able at some point in time understand the importance of having a relationship with a primary care physician.
Absolutely.
And having the kinds of questions to offer to that primary care physician so that, you know, they can take time to have a real good discussion. If they're experiencing some of the signs, such as weight loss, abdominal pain, you know, bring it to the attention of the primary care physician, who can then refer you to either a specialist or to do some studies.
So we're talking about cancer and the different surgical options and everything for it. And it's just such a scary time. I was talking to somebody who was saying they found out that they had liver cancer and they had 8 months left to live, and they had to go and figure out and work on their finances for, you know, for their passing. And just how easy is it to avoid all of this just by getting those screenings?
Yeah, one of the things that we understand about these tumors is that each one is its own individual entity. Not one liver cancer from one person will behave like the same liver cancer in another person. So, and it also depends upon the stage of presentation. Is it in just one lobe, a small lesion, or is it multiple lesions in the lobe or multiple lesions in both lobes? Because the liver is made up of a right and left lobe. And so, you know, those are nuances that actually will determine how someone will survive.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and go straight to the phone lines. We have Sally. Sally, you are on Ask the Doctor. How are you doing on this very cold Saturday?
I'm hanging in there.
Good to hear.
My question is that in 2011, I had a Whipple procedure for an IPMN in the uncinate area. And then just recently, I started having pancreatitis, and after an EUS, we found out that that's because I have another IPMN that's developed in the main duct of the body, and they're having difficulty regulating, you know, not my blood sugar yet, although it is starting to go up, but the pancreatitis, I have about every week. And I'm considering having the pancreas removed and wonder how successful the surgery is and how do patients do after that.
Well, Sally, you give a very a good story there, and congratulations on being a survivor of the Whipple operation. You know, it's a very complex procedure.
And can I mention one more thing?
Yes.
My father and two sisters died of pancreatic cancer. All within 2 years of each other, right around the time that I had my surgery.
So sorry to hear that.
I see. So, you know, giving me that little tidbit of information regarding the family history, you know, there is an awareness as it relates to understanding how other family members in your family, even particularly the next generation, have to be able to establish a relationship with the physician early and help them to understand, look, I may be at risk of developing pancreas cancer. I would like to be part of a screening program, if not part of a research program, to assure that maybe I can provide information as well as get an earlier diagnosis as opposed to a late diagnosis. But with regards to your particular question, you know, of course, you know, having been identified now with the pancreatitis, you know, you have what has developed here, a recurrence of the intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasm. That's what IPM stands for. Is affecting your ducts. And that's why you're getting the pancreatitis. You know, after a big operation such as a Whipple resection, which sometimes can take between 4 to 6 hours, it really is very complex. Certainly, any surgeon who has to go back into that abdomen has to deal with that reconstruction that took place initially. It is doable. You just have to be prepared for, you know, a lot of things that have to be done for medical management after your pancreas is removed.
So it seems like that's the best option for me, considering the family history.
Very true, yes, yes.
You know, I'm basically kind of waiting for them to say, okay, it's developed into cancer again. And well, I don't want that to happen.
Well, I think that's why the physicians and the team that you're working with is offering you to have that pancreatectomy done.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. And patients, I know I'm already taking enzymes, and I know I would be an insulin-dependent diabetic.
Yes, that's very true.
So, but it can be controlled.
Yes, it can. It's going to be a tough course, but you can make it. I think that's what's the first thing that's very good to hear about is that you have this attitude that you're going to make this happen. You're going to go through it.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Doctor. I appreciate your answer.
Thanks for your question.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And sorry to hear about the pancreatitis, Sally. I know how painful that can be. And, you know, best of luck to you. Best wishes. We're talking about cancer right here. We talked about surgery a little bit leading up to it. Let's talk about life after surgery. Mm-hmm. Somebody that has ended up having to do the liver resection to mm-hmm. treat their cancer. What is that like?
Well, I think that what's helpful is that today's surgical procedures are associated with very good outcomes as it relates to liver resections because of the technology. Certainly, when anyone's undergoing any liver resection, bleeding is a risk factor, infection is a risk factor, and bile leak is a risk factor. But those don't really happen as often as they used to, you know, 20, 30 years ago. We have a lot of good surgical equipment that prevents these things from happening. We have good critical care staff that allows for the patients to recover very well. And once this is done well, you know, depending upon the stage of the presentation, patients overall do very well.
I've heard comparatively that this is actually, you know, one of the safer surgeries you can do. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that true?
Yes, overall it is. I think one of the things is understanding how much liver has to be removed in order to provide, you know, cure for the patient. Mm-hmm. It all depends upon the overall health status of that patient. What is the status of the regular liver itself? You know, were they exposed to tobacco and or alcohol and the liver is kind of just struggling already? But overall, you can do at least 50% of the liver can be removed. Like I said before, if we do certain techniques in order to help the rest of the liver to grow while the area where the tumor is to die off, then you can still have, you know, up to maybe 2/3 of the liver taken off.
I got you. Well, Dr. Hill, stay with us. We have one more segment coming up. And if you're listening, we are taking your phone calls. The number to call is 904-340-1045. You are listening to Ask the Doctor here on News 104.5 WOKV. Dr. Hill here in the studio with us. He's a general surgeon and surgical oncologist at St. Vincent's. Dr. Hill, we are here. We're talking about the different kinds of cancer, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, and how it spreads from one area to another. How important is it for somebody to get a second opinion if they've been diagnosed with something, if they don't feel right about what their physician has said to them?
Oh, that's very critical. I think one of the things is that the first line of information would normally come from a physician that may not necessarily be truly an oncologist. So it's very important to get a second opinion from someone who has actually done perhaps a fellowship like myself in the area of oncology, understanding tumor biology, understanding tumor behavior, understanding the nuances about that very particular type of tumor. You know, breast cancer will not behave like colorectal cancer, will not behave like melanoma. You know, and that's what's important is understanding how these behave. Like I alluded to earlier, that molecular profiling, genetic profiling of these tumors have led to researchers developing state-of-the-art customized therapies as it relates to those particular tumors. So one person may be classified to have a low-risk recurrent type of tumor versus one that has a high-risk recurrent tumor, and those molecular profile therapies help to be specific for that type of patient. It's very critical, very helpful.
And your office is on the south side?
At St. Vincent's Southside, also have an office at St. Vincent's Riverside in the Dillon Building.
Okay, and screening, second opinions on management, all that good stuff?
We could discuss all that. I think what's helpful is also understanding that genetic testing is important to help to determine whether or not you're a carrier of a gene that puts you at risk for developing cancer as well.
Yeah, there are definitely tests for that, genetic mutations. Well, thank you, Hill, so much.